Today's International Edition. Coming up, the Ukraine president offers amnesty for pro-Russians occupying buildings. Lebanon prelates urge an end to Syrian weapon sales. The OECD issues some exciting news for developing nations.
This is really, truly great news for the poor of the world.
President Obama seeks improved safety for U.S. troops. And the Big Apple weighs fees on single-use plastic bags. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. Ukraine's acting president, Oleksandr Turchynov, is promising amnesty for pro-Russian demonstrators if they give up their weapons and abandon government buildings under siege in two eastern cities. Mr. Turchynov said today he is willing to make his promise official in a presidential proclamation. NATO's top military commander in Europe said on Wednesday that countermoves to the Russian military threat against Ukraine could include sending American troops to alliance nations in Eastern Europe feeling at risk. NATO foreign ministers have asked U.S. Air Force General Philip Breedlove to propose steps to reassure NATO members nearest Russia that other alliance countries have their back. General Philip Breedlove spoke with the Associated Press.
Essentially, what we are looking at is a package of land, air, and maritime measures that would build assurance for our easternmost allies. And we are directed to develop those land, air, and maritime packages so that it also addresses sort of the northern allies, the center allies, and the southern allies.
General Breedlove also spoke about the buildup of Russian troops near Ukraine's eastern border.
I would characterize it as a combined arms army. In other words, this is an army that has all of the provisioning and enablers that it needs to accomplish military objectives if given them. Fixed wing aircraft, rotary wing aircraft, artillery, tactical supply in some units, strategic supply in some units, field hospitals, communication, jamming gear, all of the things that it needs to accomplish any sort of objective given in Ukraine.
NATO's top military commander, U.S. Air Force General Philip Breedlove, speaking Wednesday in Brussels with the Associated Press. A high-level Christian delegation from Lebanon is calling for nations to stop selling weapons to the warring factions in Syria. Prelates say these arms are fueling the war and impeding peace efforts. Lisa Schlein filed this report Wednesday.
A high-ranking delegation of Maronite prelates from Lebanon is at the United Nations in Geneva to press its case for peace in the Middle East and, in particular, for Syria. Archbishop Paul Saya, who is vicar general to the Patriarch in Lebanon, says the war in Syria will stop when everybody stops selling arms to those who are fighting. He tells VOA those who are supplying weapons have no thought for the suffering and misery endured by the civilian population. He says their interest is for political or economic gain. He says this is unacceptable.
They should stop supplying arms to everybody, and then people will come and sit together and talk peace. As long as they are fed with arms and political support and money, people will continue. It's good business for everybody. As long as Assad thinks he's going to win, he's not going to stop. If the others think they're going to win, they will never stop. But they will know once those who are supplying the arms stop supplying the arms that eventually they'll have to stop.
Archbishop Saya says the delegation, which is led by His Beatitude Cardinal Bechara, held a somewhat depressing meeting with UN envoy for Syria, Lakhdar Brahimi. He says the UN mediator feels disillusioned and sees no way forward in the peace process at the moment.
It looks like he's not going to be there for very long either. I'm sure somebody else will have to pick up the problem, but start again, go back to square one. And this is waste of time. This is waste of lives.
More than 130,000 people reportedly have been killed during the past 3 years of civil war in Syria. Around 9 million have been displaced in and outside the country. Lebanon, which is a much smaller country than Syria, recently registered its 1 millionth refugee. Archbishop Saya says this huge number of refugees is placing an intolerable burden upon the political, social, and economic well-being of Lebanon. He says the refugees also are causing security concerns.
The way things are at the moment, all those people are scattered all over the place in among the population. They take the jobs of the Lebanese. You know, they are now causing a lot of security problems, you know, with kidnapping, with murder, with all sorts of violence, because those people are hungry. You know, they kidnap somebody and they ask for money. Why? Because, you know, simply they're hungry. I'm not condoning, you know, but that's the situation.
The Archbishop says he and his fellow prelates support the Lebanese government's proposition that refugee camps for Syrians should be established either in safe areas inside Syria or in the no man's land between Syria and Lebanon. Under this plan, he says the United Nations would provide security for the camps and the UN Refugee Agency and other humanitarian organizations would provide relief supplies to the refugees. He says the delegation has discussed this proposal with the UN director and other officials in Geneva, but as of now, he says, the delegation has not received a definite response as to whether the United Nations will or will not subscribe to this plan. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Negotiators from Iran and the so-called P5 plus one, the United States, Russia, China, Britain, and France plus Germany, wrapped up a round of talks on Iran's nuclear program Wednesday in Vienna. The West believes Tehran is trying to build a nuclear weapon, a charge they deny. Henry Ridgewell reports negotiators remain a long way from reaching agreement.
This is the third time negotiators from Iran and the P5 plus one have met this year in Vienna. EU Foreign Affairs Chief Catherine Ashton, who is coordinating the talks, admitted to significant gaps between the parties.
A lot of intensive work will be required to overcome the differences which naturally still exist at this stage in the process.
All sides hope to sign a comprehensive agreement by a self-imposed July 20th deadline. Iran leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei has insisted in the past Iran will never give up nuclear enrichment or shut any nuclear facility. But the United States and the European Union are demanding limits on Iran's efforts to develop more efficient enrichment technology. They want to extend the breakout period, the time it would take Iran to make a nuclear bomb, currently estimated to be 2 months. Speaking Tuesday to Congress, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry warned Tehran the United States will respond if Iran takes that path.
If they're overtly breaking out and breaking an agreement and starting to enrich and pursue it, they've made a huge consequential decision. And the greater likelihood is we are going to respond immediately.
In return for scaling back its nuclear program, Iran wants the West to lift sanctions that have crippled its economy. Optimism over the talks has sparked interest from many Western companies, says CEO Nigel Kushner of W Legal in London, which advises firms on trading with countries subject to sanctions.
A lot of different exporters and a lot of different industries who all wish to jump back into the Iranian market.
Aviation is set to be one of the first entrants into that market. Years of sanctions on the sale of aircraft and spare parts to Iran have left its passenger fleet decrepit. Aviation analysts say there have been dozens of incidents related to worn-out aircraft. The head of Iran Air was at the talks in Vienna to negotiate an easing of sanctions on the sale of aircraft parts. It will be a gradual process, says Nigel Kushner.
First of all, it applies mainly to Iran Air. It doesn't include a number of other Iranian airlines, for example, Mahan Air. They can't avail themselves of this opportunity. And it is limited to spare parts. They can't go out and purchase new planes.
Negotiators hope to build on the tentative agreements when they meet again May the 13th in Vienna. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
The medical aid group Doctors Without Borders describes conditions at a camp for the displaced in South Sudan as appalling. The group, also known as MSF, accuses the UN mission of not doing enough to protect thousands of people there. UN officials deny the accusation and say protecting civilians is their top concern. VOA's Joe DiCapua has details.
About 21,000 people are crowded into the Tomping UN peacekeeping base in Juba. People fled to the base after fighting broke out between government forces and rebels in December. Stefan Lilegrian, MSF project coordinator in Juba, describes conditions in Tamping.
They are cramped up in a very, very tiny area, which is known to be flood-prone. And floods has already happened due to rain. The humanitarian organizations have been pushing for more space. The UN Miss here in Juba are really putting a lot of obstacles for humanitarians working here in this area. One obstacle after the other are being presented to us. Instead of finding solutions for the problems, they are postponing and changing ideas, and they're giving a piece of land and taking it back again.
He says just getting from shelter to shelter is a problem.
People have their houses in standing water, and to reach to a lot of these houses now, you have to walk through water that are 10, 15, 20 centimeters deep.
MSF warns conditions are ripe for an epidemic of diarrheal, respiratory, and skin diseases. UNMISS has announced plans to close the Tamping camp next month and move people to a base known as UN House or Juba House. It's on higher ground. The MSF project coordinator says it sounds good, but there are problems.
It's not a bad idea to move these people to another location, but the time framing on this is completely out of sync because the new place will not be ready in time to move these people. And meantime, more spaces needs to be allocated within the UN compound so we can prevent potential very bad spread of diseases here.
Lilegrian says heavy rains will greatly slow or block any move to the UN House location, which already holds 11,000 displaced people. What's more, he says, that humanitarian groups have encountered repeated obstacles or refusals from UNMISS to get more space in Tamping.
Some people are really understanding the situation and are really helping us, but then local commanders or battalion chiefs are blocking, no, you cannot have this space because I need it for my battalion, and some other commanders say, no, I need this one for containers, and another one say, I need this, and nobody's giving.
He rejects UNMISS's assertion that it's doing all it can to help and protect civilians.
They are not doing everything they can, not at all. They could have done a lot more, a lot sooner. We have been asking for this for a long time.
UNMISS spokesperson Ariane Quantier agrees conditions are bad at the Tamping base, saying the situation is of great concern.
It is of great concern for two reasons. One is that this place is not meant and appropriate to have thousands of people living there, but it is congested. And it's always been congested from the first day because people literally flocked into our site, fleeing for safety when the violence erupted. The other concern is, of course, the rainy season. That makes the conditions even worse.
She says UNMISS is well aware of the danger of a possible disease outbreak.
If you take the combination of these two elements, which is the congestion of the camp and the rainy season, you have a situation where these protection sites are turning into death trap, because if there is an outbreak of disease, this will spread throughout the area like wildfire.
Quantier says UNMISS has a two-part strategy to deal with the situation.
One is to try to have people relocating on a voluntary basis to other areas. What I'm calling other areas is either extension of existing sites that we have on our compound or new sites on land made available to us by the government. And this is something we've asked the authorities from the very first day, to have more land to be able to decongest the site.
About 1,500 people of the 21,000 at Tamping have been relocated to other sites so far. Part two of the strategy, she says, is improving conditions at existing sites, including water, sanitation, and basic health services.
We have been saving thousands of lives by the mere fact of opening our gates and having, for the last 3.5 months, over 80,000 people who have stayed on our bases. And I think this is what the people wanted. They voted with their feet. They are still on our side. And I think UNMISS has saved 85,000 lives, plus prevented the country in descending into worse chaos.
Quantier says UNMISS has a duty to protect them. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
U.S. President Barack Obama says more must be done to improve the safety and health of U.S. troops, both in war zones and at home. Mr. Obama made his remarks at a ceremony paying tribute to the victims of the April 2nd shooting in Fort Hood, Texas. president's visit to the southwestern state includes attending the commemoration of 50 years since the signing of the U.S. historic Civil Rights Act. Sladek Hoke reports.
We must honor these men.
Love was the central theme of President Obama's speech Wednesday at a memorial ceremony for three servicemen killed by a fellow soldier at Fort Hood earlier this month. He said it was love for their country that inspired these soldiers to join the army, and love that will help their families overcome the grief surrounding their loss.
Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never ends.
Last week, a disgruntled soldier killed himself and three others at Fort Hood, where an army psychiatrist killed 13 people in a shooting spree in 2009. President Obama said the latest tragedy reopens the old wounds and that more needs to be done to secure U.S. military facilities.
In our open society, in a vast basis like this, we can never eliminate every risk, but as a nation, we can do more to help counsel those with mental health issues, to keep firearms out of the hands of those who are having such deep difficulties. As a military, we must continue to do everything in our power to secure our facilities and spare others this pain.
Army Chief of Staff General Ray Odierno said it is not clear why wartime hardships make some soldiers stronger, while others struggle with the effects. He said the Army will do more to address the problem.
We will also do everything within our power to investigate every detail, to learn, to adapt, and to protect our most valuable resource, the men and women of our U.S. Army.
Secretary of the Army John McHugh praised the victims for their bravery, which he said saved many other lives.
We may never know how many lives were saved or how many others might have been lost were it not for these heroes. But know this, we are incredibly grateful for their bravery and even more humbled by their selflessness.
On Thursday, President Obama joins former Presidents Jimmy Carter, Bill Clinton, and George W. Bush in the state capital, Austin, to honor the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act. The legislation outlawed racial discrimination in voting, schools, public accommodations, and the workplace. Zlatica Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development recently made an announcement they are very excited about. The OECD reports development aid rose by 6.1% in real terms in 2013 to reach the highest level recorded. And a survey of the donor spending plans of the organization's Development Assistance Committee indicates aid levels could increase again in 2014. Eric Solheim, chairman of DAC, spoke with us about the jump in aid.
This happened because a huge number of nations, despite economic suffering and despite economic crisis, have actually increased the development assistance. Clear examples for sure is the United Arab Emirates, which is the lead in the world. Turkey has increased a lot, United Kingdom, Japan. A huge number of nations have actually increased. So the doomsayers who said that when there is economic crisis, development assistance is doomed to be reduced, they are proven wrong. So this is really, truly great news for the poor of the world.
And why has this happened?
I think because a number of political leaders have taken the lead. I mean, the United Kingdom has increased the development spending to 0.7, which is the global target, even at the time of crisis, because Prime Minister Cameron believes in it. Same with Prime Minister Erdogan of Turkey. He has increased Turkish assistance. And these are just two outstanding examples. But the majority of nations have increased. A small number of nations have decreased. But overall, we have reached the highest level ever recorded. Adding to that, for sure, donors outside OECD, like China, is stepping up. And so are charitable foundations like, say, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation.
Where is most of the money going to at this point?
Going to all the developing nations, both middle income and the very poor. one very important issue for us is that we need to increase the spending in the least developed nations, and particularly in the fragile states which are ravaged by war and conflict, like Central African Republic or South Sudan or Somalia. But it's spent for education, health, road building, whatever is needed all over the developing world.
Well, now after this big win, where do you go? What's next?
We need to increase spending further, but we also need to be much smarter, use development assistance to leverage more and better private investment, and to use development assistance to assist tax systems so that nations can mobilize domestic resources, not just international resources, for development. A huge number of developing nations can pay for their own development if they can get assistance to get the tax systems right, and in particular to mobilize the resources from oil and gas and minerals.
Well, thank you very much and congratulations.
Thank you. It's a great day. We are very happy.
Oh, good. And you enjoy it. I was speaking with Eric Solheim, chairman of the Development Assistance Committee at the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development in Paris. The world consumes hundreds of billions of single-use plastic bags each year. Environmental activists say they are difficult to recycle, wasteful, and damage the biosphere. They want to ban plastic bags or, as many communities have done, charge a fee for them at the register. But the plastic bag industry defends their use, saying people reuse plastic bags, and industry officials argue recycling is a matter of personal responsibility and should not be regulated. VOA's Adam Phillip has more on the controversy from New York.
City officials say that New Yorkers use 5.2 billion plastic bags each year. They're offered free with nearly every supermarket, pharmacy, or convenience store purchase. Many people like them.
And that's how they package things these days.
They're easy to use, they're lightweight, they're easy to store.
I don't feel good about it, but I use it sometimes, you know, because it's convenient.
But what happens to those bags after they've been used is a huge environmental problem, says Lily Bellinger of NoImpactProject.org.
They're found on beaches, they're found clogging storm drains, they're caught in trees, they're swallowed by marine life. And once that happens, we actually eat the marine life. So what's bad for the planet is almost always also bad for us.
Plastic bags are made of petroleum products and natural gas and do not biodegrade. And Bellinger says they're difficult to recycle. So New York City spends nearly $10 million a year to send 100,000 tons of plastic bags to landfills out of state. Attorney Jenny Romer of PlasticBagLaws.org helps craft state and local legislation to either ban plastic bags or charge a fee for their use. She says nearly 150 American municipalities have already done so, to good effect.
Washington, D.C., a 5-cent charge on all single-use bags led to about a 60% reduction. And in Los Angeles County in California, a ban on plastic bags and 10-cent charge on paper bags led to a 95% reduction in single-use bag use overall.
Environmental activists and some New York City council members are proposing a law to charge 10 cents for all single-use plastic bags. That's government overreach, says Mark Daniels of the American Progressive Bag Alliance, an industry trade group. He spoke via Skype.
You know, it's your personal responsibility as well. If you shop at a convenience store and buy a pack of gum and a Coke, it does not necessarily need a plastic bag. You can refuse that.
Jenny Romer counters that people usually don't refuse a free convenience.
But with a 10-cent charge on bags, customers are much more likely to stop and think about whether they need a bag or not. And that's really all that these laws are doing.
Mark Daniels says most people reuse plastic bags at home, and limiting the use of American-made bags will cost jobs in the plastic bag manufacturing sector and in recycling centers. Environmental groups are racing to put an increasing number of plastic bag fee proposals on ballots and before city and state legislators as the federal government reports a dramatic rise in the number of plastic bags Americans use every year. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yockey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On April 10, 1815, the biggest volcanic eruption in history occurred at Mount Tambora in southern Indonesia. More than 90,000 people were killed. Volcanic ash from the eruption caused widespread crop failure. Global temperatures dropped an average of 3 degrees Celsius, and Europe experienced what was known as the year without summer. On this date in 1829, English Methodist clergyman William Booth was born. Booth helped organize the Salvation Army, one of the largest religious and humanitarian aid organizations in the world. Also born on this day in 1847 was Joseph Pulitzer. The Hungarian immigrant to America took up newspaper reporting as a young man, eventually becoming a powerful newspaper publisher. In his will, he established the Pulitzer Prizes that continue to recognize excellence in journalism. In 1872, at the urging of newspaper man and future agriculture secretary J. Sterling Morton, more than a million trees were planted on what would become the first American Arbor Day. Similar celebrations are observed around the world. In 1925, American writer F. Scott Fitzgerald's classic, The Great Gatsby, was first published. The book explores the societal decadence rampant during the period of U.S. history known as the Roaring Twenties. On this day in 1970, a promotional self-interview by Paul McCartney was seized upon by the media as an official announcement that the iconic rock band The Beatles had broken up. Promoting a new solo album, McCartney didn't specifically say that The Beatles had split up, but strongly hinted at it when he said his days as a songwriting collaborator with fellow Beatle John Lennon had ended. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
More than 150,000 people have been killed in Syria since Bashar al-Assad first used force against peaceful anti-government demonstrators 3 years ago. Now, added to that horrific toll is yet another killing of a prominent Catholic priest, a Dutchman by birth, who lived and worked in Syria for nearly 50 years and considered his home to be among the Christians and Muslims who once lived peacefully together in the city of Homs. Jesuit priest Franz van der Lucht was shot to death in Homs on April 7th. He had gained international prominence through a video clip released earlier this year when he described how Syrians in the city were dying of malnutrition after the delivery of food and other humanitarian assistance was blocked for months by the Syrian regime. Father van der Lucht insisted on staying in Homs even after more than 1,000 people were allowed evacuated in February. He ministered to a dwindling Christian community and worked to help both poor Christian and Muslim families. The Syrian people have given me so much kindness. If they are suffering now, I want to share their pain and their difficulties, he had said. No one has claimed responsibility for Father van der Lucht's death, which was strongly condemned by Syria's opposition national council. In a statement, the council said it firmly supported the quest to find and hold accountable those who perpetrated what it called this cowardly act. U.S. State Department spokesperson Jen Psaki also denounced the violent attack that killed Father van der Lucht, whom she commended for his lifelong support of the Syrian people, and she condemned all attacks against innocent civilians and minority communities.
As we have said throughout this conflict, we deplore continued threats against Christians in Syria, and we reiterate that we stand on the side of the Syrian people who are fighting for a Syria that is inclusive and pluralistic and respects all faiths.
Father van der Lucht once said, "I don't see Muslims or Christians. I see, above all, human beings who hunger to lead a normal life." That hunger survives the death of this advocate for the Syrian people, one who counted his place among them. The Assad regime must work to move forward on a negotiated political transition that can end the conflict and the suffering of the Syrian people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.